Hi, and welcome to The Thread, Fashion Marketing Unraveled. This podcast is being created by the students, the staff, alumni, and industry partners from the Masters in Strategic Fashion Marketing at the London College of Fashion. Our course is the online course and one of many postgraduate courses that exist within a fashion business school. And we learn through a range of methods. We learn through audio because it gives us time away from our screen. We learn through visual content because it helps us feel a humanistic connection. And we, of course, learn through the classic written word. So rather than just use secondary resources, we want to create our own primary resource, and thus The Thread is born. This podcast content is all about exploring topics that interest our students studying for fashion marketing and looking at it from both the industry side and, of course, how they manifest through their studies. We really want to hear your comments. We love a bit of critique, but we also love praise. So let us know. In this week's episode, Max Tookie, Lois Gilbert and Hannah Kane will explore the Masters project.
Hello everyone, my name is Hannah Kane and I am a lecturer in fashion marketing here at the London College of Fashion Fashion Business School. And today on The Thread, Fashion Marketing Unraveled, I have here with me Lois Gilbert, one of our star students from the last year's cohort, and Max Tookie, Dr. Max Tookie, who's one of our key supervisors here as well.
Hello.
Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. So let's start with chapter one, The Big Idea. Lois, can you start, please, by telling us what inspired your master's project?
Yeah, so hi, everyone. First of all, my project was titled The Art of Artification, an exploratory study abductively analysing British Gen Z luxury consumer value perceptions of artified fashion at the Met Gala. And I think kind of what inspired me was, for one, I always have been really interested in the Met Gala as a kind of concept and an exhibition and a kind of PR event. I just thought it was so interesting the way that kind of celebrity and art can kind of mix together in that form. So that was kind of the thing that drew me. And also my BA was in art history and I really wanted to kind of incorporate my knowledge of art into kind of an academic sense in as many ways as I could.
That's great. So it became a real sort of personal project for you.
Definitely, yeah.
And Max, as supervisor, what are your tips for coming up with a great idea for a master's project?
I think it's an interesting question, Hannah. I think you've really got to love what you do. I think if you love what you do, it comes across in your writing. So, you know, read around it. Make sure that it's something that's original, it's something that's innovative, and it's something that you feel passionate about. And I think I've read a lot of master's degrees in the time I've been, you know, working as a lecturer, supervised a lot, and all sorts of things make a really good degree, a master's degree, like, you know, a good methodology section, good literature review, being thorough. But what really comes across is the person who writes it likes it. And that is really, really important. You have a sense of agency empowerment when you actually write the dissertation. And I think, you know, that's an important thing that comes across. And also, you know, maybe some contribution to knowledge. I mean, a PhD is normally contribution to knowledge, but even a good master's degree is something that does something a bit more original. You know, I've read lots of stuff over the years, and sometimes you get this sort of eureka moment where you go, wow, that's really good. And that's important.
And following on from that, Max, you know, I had a question. How do you uncover a research gap? And also, Lois, this could be for you as well. So, yeah, how do you find that research gap, that original contribution to knowledge that you're looking for?
I think I found just reading as much as possible. I know that everyone always says that, but it really, really is the way you have to do it. I think if you read as much as you can, there's no way that you're not going to find something really amazing and really like nuanced. And obviously the whole idea is finding something original and finding something nuanced. So I think, yeah, it really is just about reading as much as possible, even reading things that you think might not be that relevant, because I think sometimes those are the ones that really surprise you, and that's really how you kind of find the...
That's a great tip, having that sort of depth of knowledge of the industry and other topics.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. I think it's also implicit in your reading that you've read something and you find gaps. There's something that someone hasn't uncovered before and you explore that more and you see something different. It's almost like this sort of serendipitous moment when you do research. You think, that seems familiar yet different at the same time, and you go with that. And I've read, you know, really good dissertations where the contribution and the gap and what they're filling in is there and it's apparent. And when people do either the hypothesis or the research questions, you see what that is. So yeah, I think that's important, you know, to read, but to ask critical questions when you read. Critical questions are really important, you know, when you read a good piece of work.
And another question for the both of you, does it need to be topical?
Yes. I'll tell you why. Knowledge changes all the time, and ideas are knowledge. And there is the zeitgeist, the sort of spirit of the age about things that are topical, and they change all the time. And I think that, you know, if you are onto something that is quite exciting, is quite whiz-bang, and is getting people excited, like, you know, like your dissertation, it's something that people won't forget. So topicality in a project is really, really important. I mean, I've marked PhD students, I've marked master students over the years. Sometimes you see the same stuff all the time, but sometimes you see difference, and that difference is really, really important. So yeah, if you make it topical, I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Would you agree with that, Lewis?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. Definitely.
Great. Another question for the both of you, please. And let's start with Max on this one, please. Can you explain how to craft a great research question? Because I know that this is something our students struggle with.
Sure, sure. I think a good research question is something that's original, and it's something that is really focused on the key thing you're looking at in your research. So your topic, artification, brilliant. You crafted research questions around that, and they were focused on that. So the key is to keep the focus on the main area and to have a relationship between the main focus and the other things you're looking at. Now, with research questions, what happens is you do qualitative research, you map out a conceptual framework, and then the conceptual framework changes. Now, I recently did another MA where I did that, and I actually found it quite enjoyable because you're not testing things, you're examining things, so you're looking at the validity of the research. But the thing with a good research question is originality, well articulated, and I like the KISS formula: keep it short and simple, keep it straightforward, and it works really well if you do that. That's from my experience. I mean, I've read lots of research questions which have been kind of quite long-winded and quite, you know, you need to get to the point. So that principle of almost brevity, the KISS principle, short and simple, keeps to the point, and you know what you're focused on. And you see, the other good thing is, with a research question, you see how the research questions have a sort of continuity with the whole theme of the dissertation, and it runs through the whole theme. And that's really good. I mean, there's lots of things that make a first-class piece of work, but that's one of them. So to answer the question, yeah, all of those elements make a good piece, a good research question.
I think as well, I mean, I know you were saying how they should be short and sweet. I think mine was pretty long.
It wasn't, though. I think you've got to the point.
It definitely was longer in like previous drafts, but I think looking back, I would say definitely brevity, but also knowing, I think you don't want it to be too basic.
No.
You want it to be a nice amount of, you know, it's a master's, you need to make it like academic and like fancy, but also just informative, concise. And there obviously needs to be that reference to fashion marketing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which I think was kind of, you know, it's something that I obviously knew I had to do, but along the way you get kind of lost in other avenues and... But yeah, it has to be obviously related to fashion marketing.
Yeah,
and how many times do you think you revised your research question from start to finish?
Probably like 10 plus.
Okay.
Probably,
that's,
yeah.
That's
there
quite
was a lot of
as well, isn't it?
Yeah. There was a lot of different drafts.
That's quite normal. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is when people do research, they start off with ideas about research questions, which are sort of, they think, we'll do this and they'll do this. And they read stuff. And then when they read stuff, I mean, you probably experienced this.
100%.
Yeah, exactly. The research question changes. And when it changes, you realise, I didn't look at this, I didn't look at this, I didn't look at this. So a master's dissertation, like a PhD, is an iterative process. It changes all the time. It's always evolving. Mm. It's always doing other stuff.
And don't think that you have to get it right the first time. Because you can be changing it, you know, up until like the month before.
Oh, absolutely.
A few weeks before.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've supervised lots of people in the past who have, you know, research questions which are really good, and they found something else and then they changed them. But it's fine. Mm-hmm. It's keeping the thing on focus, which is important. And that's really good.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's move on to chapter two, the literature review. So Max, as supervisor, what are you looking for in terms of the lit review?
I'm excited about it. I see stuff and I think, I didn't know that. That's really good. It falls into place. And the other thing is about a good literature review, someone said this to me, there is an evolution in it. And you probably think, what do I mean by evolution? You see where the ideas come from. So your stuff, artification, where the history comes from. And you did lots of stuff on the luxury markets and stuff mm-hmm. that was really good. And then it follows this nice sort of stream of ideas that follow one particular argument and they bring in other things. And those other things form your research questions or your hypothesis. But I think the thing is, what makes a really good literature review is it is topical, of course. It's up to date. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, not stuff, not papers written in the early part of the 20th century. Good up-to-date research. You know, some master's dissertations I've seen have had 2023 research in. I know you did in yours, Lewis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, up-to-date, original. And you read it. I think this is, someone said this to me. The key thing is you read it and you think, I've learned something actually reading this. I've actually read this and I think I didn't know this. This actually is really informative to me.
Yeah.
And you've learned something from the process. It's not just someone's written something that you know about and they've asked some interesting questions. You actually read it and the thing is actually an education in addition to being well written, in addition to using verbs, using tenses, you know, good stylistic stuff's important as well. But really, you know, it's a joy to read and you want to read it more.
Yeah,
I found that with good dissertations. You read something, you think, wow, that's mm-hmm. interesting. And then you read and read and read.
I agree. I mean, this is one of the reasons I really love teaching the master's course is because, you know, it keeps you right at the forefront of your own academic practice and your own research.
Absolutely,
And then, you know, for us as lecturers, we can take that out into our work as well. You know, and I'm always finding great papers in students' work and saving them and using them for things.
Absolutely.
But Lois, was there anything that you found particularly challenging in terms of the secondary research?
I think when you have loads of ideas and when you find a topic you really love, there is so much out there that you can look at. It makes it really hard to streamline what you're going to talk about and what you want to actually put in there, because there's actually not that many words. Well, for me, I felt like there wasn't that many words when it came down to it, and you have to be quite like precious with the ones you choose to use. So I think it was being able to organize my thoughts and organize these different kind of arguments and veins I wanted to go down and actually choose the ones which would be most relevant. So it's a process. It definitely takes like, you know, planning loads of different things out and then actually seeing which work the best. But I think it is about like ordering your thoughts, definitely.
And in terms of that organization, and this is a question for both of you, how do you recommend organizing your secondary research process?
I think read, make notes, filter down, come to key areas. So it is there is an editorial aspect to it, literally, mm-hmm. where you're reading something and you think, that's really good. How does this fit into this? And then come up with key areas. Mm-hmm. So when you do a really good literature review, you see the evolution, you see the key arguments, and then you see the areas. But what makes a really good literature review is criticality. So you're not just saying something that we know about, you're being critical with the literature. Mm-hmm. So you see that kind of critical argument. So thinking about critical debates that you can put into the literature is a really fantastic thing to do. So it is about reading, so breaking it down into key areas, but having critical discussions in the research. And the other thing that makes a really good literature review, of course, is the idea of the theatrical contributions to the research, what theories you're using, whether it's, you know, theories about fashion choices, psychology theories, etc., and how they inform the literature. So all of those things should be in. So it's breaking it down really into key areas, critical discussion, critical arguments, and then theatrical underpinnings.
Mm-hmm. I think a great way to do that, like if you're kind of a visual learner, which I am, after you've made the note, like initial notes, is you can go into like something like Miro or Canva and get post-it notes and get the key themes around them, maybe put like key authors around them. And then you can, you know, kind of note how the authors might interact with each other and how maybe there's like concurrence between these two, or these two really disagree on this. And then visually seeing it will really help you be able to map out and structure how you're going to write the chapter two.
Did you use Canva in yours?
I use Miro mostly, Miro, okay. But I think Canva would be kind of similar thing.
That's a great explanation of how to progress your critical analysis right from the initial stages. Good tip. I was thinking, actually, I've been using a lot of AI recently, and there's this platform called Cite, SCITE.AI. And that's really good for sentiment analysis within research papers. So you can actually type in your research question.
That's interesting.
And this is
that's
brand new. Yeah. And if you put in your research question, it will come up with lists of suggested papers for you to read. And obviously then you have to use your own thoughts your judgment about how to edit and prune that. But it is
do you know what's quite exciting about AI, really, Hannah, is it's giving... like a boost to the whole research process. It's giving you a little bit of a sort of leg up in terms of saying, you know, you can do things differently with the help of technology. And I think working hard is good, but working smart is even better. And I'm a big advocate of working smart, you know. And anything that you can do that makes your life simple in research is fantastic.
Cite is great. You know, it trawls through thousands upon thousands of articles and will help come up with some of the most relevant views. So it's saving a lot of time in the research process. And also things like Claude AI are very good as well. You can copy and paste the text from an article in and ask for, you know, the list of the key themes in this paper as well.
Sure, that's really good.
Yeah. So Max, I know that you had a couple of questions that you wanted to ask Lois as well.
Yeah, in the project, Lois, and this is an interesting one, you included a wide range of literature on luxury. And a thing I remember reading was why the luxury market is becoming democratized, especially for Gen Zs. Why do you think it's the case? Is the luxury market becoming more democratized now based on what you read?
I think that because Gen Z as a cohort have grown up so differently to the cohorts previous. And I think that that's meant that the attitudes that they have to things that were once held in such high regard, like luxury, I mean, it still is held in high regard, but I think for millennials and the people before, luxury was so highly regarded in a good way for being like materialistic and for being kind of extortionate. And now, and I think this has kind of happened maybe since COVID more, people have changed how they think about what their quality of life should be and what they should be spending their lives doing.
Sure.
And I think that people might kind of reject that, let's be frivolous and let's be like overly materialistic. Let's actually spend more time thinking about how we can do fulfilling things that actually, you know, get us, I don't know, that just make us feel more whole inside. And I think that luxury has turned into something that people associate with, decadence and excess.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of contributing to the whole idea that Gen Z are rejecting the traditional.
And you think that's changed now, the kind of excess stuff and everything?
I mean, I think that it's probably been propelled even more by things like TikTok and stuff, because so many people can voice their opinions on so many different things, and anyone can have the platform to critique anything. And it's given Gen Z that kind of microphone and the microscope critique everything. And, you know, influencers are so, I think Gen Z don't trust influencers the way that people think they do. And I think that obviously contributes more to the whole idea of luxury democratization, because Gen Z don't typically I mean, according to my research, maybe that's not even true. They don't typically think the ways that previous people did about luxury.
Okay, can I ask you a question about this idea of artification? Because I found it fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does artification mean to you? And also, the Met Gala, you know, your big focus, the big focus of your research. How was it represented in the Met Gala?
I think everything about the Met Gala is kind of saturated in artification without, I mean, even if you know it or you don't know it, I think the whole idea, even that it's an exhibition for this costume institute and them celebrating fashion as an art form in itself, is kind of the whole idea of artification anyway. But on a more kind of literal note, the celebrities are wearing these beautifully intricate costumes that have been created for themes and created with cultural and historical and art historical references kind of embedded within them, is artification in itself. And the fact that they walk along, you know, the steps of the Met as these kind of kinetic pieces of art themselves, like wearing the clothes, and then the clothes will go on to be kind of venerated and protected and, you know, kept in pristine condition in the Met and in the V&A, sure, just shows even more the fusion between fashion and art and how fashion is slowly being regarded as kind of a fine art.
That's very interesting. I mean, what did you find the most interesting thing about your research? I mean, you talked about the relationship between fashion and art. Was there anything else that came from your research that you really resonated with you?
I really found it interesting learning a lot about how art can be seen as like something really fulfilling.
Sure.
And how we can use art to kind of make luxury feel more fulfilling, kind of that achievement-driven value of owning something that looks like an artifact, that looks like it could be regarded in the same way as, like, you know, a Van Gogh or like a Picasso, because sure, of its like beauty and the reference it has to culture and stuff. And I think that, yeah, that was definitely like a turning point when I kind of put two and two together about that in my research. It was really, really interesting. Yeah,
thank you, that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting, thank you. So let's move on to chapter three, talking about primary research, findings and analysis. So Lois, how did you decide on the research methodology for your study and why did you adopt an interpretive approach?
So I think when I kind of gauged that I wanted to learn about how Gen Z felt about art and fashion and how they perceived luxury, I knew that thinking about perceptions and feelings was always going to be kind of an interpretivist approach, because that's obviously not to do with right and wrong. It's more to do with the fluidity of emotion and how there can be nuances and nothing is like, you know, correct or incorrect. And positivism is so much kind of concerned with like what's right and wrong and like rigid fact. So I knew that if I was, you know, trying to gauge perception, it would be a lot more kind of grounded in interpretivism.
Can I say one thing I really liked about your research? You used thematic apperception. I mean, you used obviously focus groups as well. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you used the approach within that approach within the context of your study?
So, yeah, thematic apperception obviously involves imagery and kind of eliciting emotions out of people based on the imagery that's presented to them. So I thought that doing a project so heavily kind of influenced by art, it would only be right to get some visual cues in there when I'm kind of talking to participants and stuff. And obviously, if I'm talking to them about the Met Gala, I want to be showing them the dresses and the clothes rather than just trying to describe to them what's going on, because it wouldn't be very efficient. So, yeah, that's why I used that.
Okay.
It's all to do with the understanding of that communicated message, really, that the artist or the wearer is trying to put out to the world.
Yeah, exactly.
A more concentrated version of everyday styling, really.
Mm-hmm.
And Lois, can you describe the key findings of your study and which findings did you find the most interesting?
Yeah, so I think the key findings were definitely that Gen Z perceive artification and artified fashion at the Met Gala as really quite fulfilling and rarefied and an amazing kind of way to or a route for luxury fashion to go down when thinking about how to appeal to Gen Z in like a changing zeitgeist, which is so kind of focused on, you know, rejecting frivolity and rejecting materialism. And I just found it so interesting. And I thought that, yeah, it's just an amazing kind of finding that I'd never seen written anywhere. Mm. And I think that was probably my favorite one. But also to do with like achievement driven value, stuff like that was really interesting.
Interesting. No, you know, and I think, like you were saying earlier, Max, having that great passion and that great interest in your data will, you know, hold you in good stead in terms of analyzing it, because as I'm sure you know, Lewis, you spend a lot of time analyzing.
A lot of time. Yeah.
So what advice would you give to students in terms of analyzing their data?
I'd say that block out as much time as possible as you can to do
we
it.
Try, we sure. do try and reiterate this every
year. As much as possible.
We definitely do.
Don't leave it till, you know, the final month or whatever. I don't know how long I spent doing it, but yeah, give it as much time as it deserves. Make it, show your like route to where you get as clear as possible, and put everything that you do in the appendix. Show every single kind of avenue you go down, every single like color coding or technique you use, put it all in the appendix, and you should be fine.
Max, can you add anything to that? What advice would you give to students?
I think she said it. Yeah. You know, I couldn't have articulated that better myself, actually. I think analysing the data is all about timing to a certain extent, because although you've got to know how to analyse it, if you don't plan it well and you leave it to the last minute, and sometimes, you know, I have this thing where I never see students and then they come to my door with a few days to spare and they want me to do something, they're going to be problems. So yeah, it's all about planning. Mm-hmm. Familiarize yourself with the techniques as well. You know, no matter what you're using.
Familiarize yourself with the data, and I think a lot of students, they're overwhelmed with the amount of data they've got from their transcripts.
Mm. Yeah.
But in my experience, you know, you just have to keep reading it through and letting it assimilate and thinking about it. There's no faster route to that.
Can I tell you what you can do actually with AI? You can actually use AI, and it's brilliant. And I did it for my master's, to actually literally put data into themes and AI. It can do it really well. And that's that's been used quite a lot. And there's nothing actually wrong with doing that, because it's not copying anything that's done. It's your stuff, and it's just creating codes with it. And it can do it lightning fast. Mm. And I've done it.
And would you put that in the appendix as well?
Yes.
Would you talk about it in your research design?
You could talk about it in the research design, but you just basically put data you've done, you know, in appendix sections, as you said, So, yeah, I mean, as I said, really working smart is good, really good.
Mm-hmm. And let's move on to chapter 4, bringing it all together for the conclusion. And Max, I know that you had a question you wanted to ask here.
Yes. Well, from experience, and I can say this because I've done a few degrees myself and I've supervised lots of people. And one thing I found out, that there's always challenges in doing research. You know, it's limitations of the research. Should I have done it this way? Should I have done it this way? It can be timing. It can be people not saying. It can be people feeling that there's some bias in the questions, or the data not being what you think it is. That happens in all research. No matter how good you think it is, it happens in all research. So with regard to you, Lewis, I mean, what were the challenges in the context of your study, and how did you address them?
I think the main challenge for me was trying to recruit participants for my primary research. And I know that a lot of people struggle with this, but I definitely struggled a lot, because I just found it hard to put myself out there with people. I didn't want to waste people's time. I didn't want to bother people. But, you know, looking back, I think I wasn't bothering anyone. Like, they should have wanted to do this. They should have wanted to be involved. Like, I should have worded it differently, probably. I should have said, like, you get to be involved in this amazing contribution to literature. I think, because that kind of paints it in a more sophisticated light. I think I was kind of being a bit more like, please do this for me. Please be in this thing for me. But yeah, in the end, I think what helped was realizing that you can go to people you know in real life. Like, I realized there's some amazing, knowledgeable industry people I already know from internships, from placements, from places I've worked, from people I just know anyway. So don't just like trawl LinkedIn. You know, there might be people that you actually know that can actually provide some really great insights for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lois, how do you recommend bringing all the threads of thought together for a persuasive conclusion?
Wow, that's a big question. I think, yeah, the conclusion has to be good. I remember Kirsty being like to me, I'd sent a draft in and she was like, this just isn't like, it's not giving. it's not like sophisticated enough yet. It has to be kind of sexy. It does. So I think, yeah, drawing it all together. Do you know what? I did a really great thematic mind map at the end of, I think it was at the end of chapter 5 actually. And it really helped me and myself understand what I'd just done and like the conclusions I was coming to. And yeah, I think that's what I'd say. Do a thematic mind map, get all of what you've done together in your mind and look at it on a piece of paper, and then it will really help you get a really amazing conclusion out of it when you can see the work that you've produced in like a visual way.
I agree. And I think kind of having that strength of writing so that you can communicate your ideas and, you know, bring all of those ideas together, that's what really elevates some of the stronger pieces of work that we look at. And Max, would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important actually that, you know, when you do a good conclusion, it's persuasive, it's balanced. You look at the pluses and the minuses. You've got some caveats and limitations in, you know, what you know, the warnings, how could you have done it differently? There isn't a panacea with this. There's no right way, you know, of doing perfect research. And it's what you learn. And reflexive practice is really good as well. Reflexive practice is this idea that you look at the research and you reflect upon what you learn from it and you acknowledge those things. And that's a really good thing to put in a conclusion as well. And a nice point at the end, you know, a little... the icing on the cake, and a nice little punchy point.
In journalism,
point.
We call it the payoff line.
Payoff line,
at the end. And again, yeah, I tell students to do that. That final sentence, you know, you want to, almost want to be slightly more poetic than the rest of the dissertation.
Yeah.
You want to leave something strong in the mind of the reader.
Sure.
You don't want an anticlimax. It has to be culminating in something good.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you want to say something
off a cliff at the end.
Absolutely. Say something at the end that people will remember.
Yeah.
And they think, wow, that's really good.
That's great, thank you. So let's move on to chapter 5, What Comes After. So Lois, what did you enjoy most from the research process?
Oh my God. I really enjoyed all of it. I know that sounds really cliche, but I love the whole process of it. I loved the lit review a lot, I think, because I loved discovery and you discover so much in the lit review. But I also did love the chapter 5, tying it all together. I think it was really satisfying to tie it all together. And I created so many different kind of diagrams in the final few weeks to really like drive the point home of what I was doing. And I found that really fun. I did them all on Canva. So yeah, I think it's a bit of the lit review and then a bit of like the chapter 5 bringing it all together was my favorite parts.
And how do you feel now reflecting on your master's journey?
I'm really, really proud. I think when you're in the thick of it, it's really hard to know what you're doing and to feel any type of way about it other than like, I just need to get this done now. But now that it's done, yeah, it's definitely my proudest like piece of work, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm proud, yeah.
That's great. And so you should be. It was a fantastic piece of work. So well done.
Thank
again.
Thank you.
And a question for both of you. So do you have any advice for students applying for jobs?
Okay, I would say with networking is really important.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea in organizational behavior, I used to lecture, of know how, know whom, and know why. Know whom is important. When you're at college, it's making those contacts. And I'll tell you a little story about that. When I did a master's degree years ago, I wasn't doing a job I particularly liked when I finished. And I was having a bad time. And I remember one day there was a phone call from someone on my master's course. And this was before I applied for a job in Cork in Ireland as a research associate. And this guy phoned me up and he said, how are you, Max? And I said, I'm okay. He said, oh, you applied for this job as a research associate. And I said, how did you know that? He said, because I'm interviewing you. And the rest is history. So the thing is... And that led to that job, that led to other jobs, and I've been lecturing ever since. And that one call changed my life, literally, that one call. It really had a massive, massive effect on me. So networking is the key. Putting yourself out there, going to job fairs, a really good CV, I can't emphasize enough, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But contacts in the industry, and contacts you know, people from your degree, people you've known, don't leave them out.
Yeah,
go for it.
Definitely.
It changed my life, that one. That one call changed me.
I think as well in fashion, it's definitely about who you know. A lot of fashion jobs, they won't even be online because they'll just hire within who they know and
stuff.
But I think, yeah, I think it's definitely about standing out in any way that you can, going above and beyond what they've asked for. And the people, yeah, if you are reaching out to people, do something that's different. Send them a voice note.
Yeah.
Send them a statement of something. Don't just be like, hey, I'd love to work with you. Say something unique. Yeah. Really do something that's going to mean they're actually going to want to engage, I think. Yeah,
absolutely.
I agree in terms of standing out. You know, we talk a lot on the course about brand differentiation.
Yeah.
And that also applies to personal brand differentiation.
Definitely.
So what is your unique selling point that you can communicate?
Make a portfolio, make something fun.
Yeah. Other things is, you know, when you meet people, have you ever met people and you want their contact details and you haven't got a card or something? I've got cards done.
Oh,
things
that's
like
fun.
That. All these little networking things are really, really important. And they all, you know, come together with helping people remember you.
Yeah.
So that first point of contact, you know, apply for jobs that fit your profile, that fit your unique selling point. And you feel comfortable. You know, when you go to an interview, you feel comfortable in it because you've researched the organization too.
Yeah.
I mean, that really works really well.
And Lois, my final question, what was it like entering the workplace with your master's qualification?
I think it definitely helped me feel like, so before I did the master's, I definitely had kind of imposter syndrome about my ability to like work in fashion because I hadn't done anything in fashion before. But I think having a master's from this university and in fashion marketing, you're in such a good position. Like you really, really are in such a good position. And you need to know your worth and don't, you know, you're here for a reason. You've done amazing to get into this course for a reason. I think it made me feel so confident in applying to things. And I think confidence helps you get the job anyway. Half the time it's like a personality thing, I think. So yeah, it definitely is about feeling confident. And it definitely, definitely helped me in reaching what I wanted to do.
Gave you something to stand behind.
Definitely, definitely. Gave me a bit more of like fun on my CV.
That's great. Well done again, Lois. You know,
thank
we're
you.
so
well
proud
done.
Of you. And Max, thank you for your
thank
time
you.
As well.
Thank you.
And thank you to the students for listening, and we will see you all soon.